It's the Audio Drama Production Podcast. You join us in the midst of our broken computer-induced reduction in service. The computer that I have that I edit the show on, it broke 2 weeks ago now today, and it's away in the shop getting fixed. And apparently they're still waiting on parts because it's 2016 and these things take weeks. But not to worry, we managed to get an interview with Mr. John Dryden, the man behind the epic Tumen Bay. It's a very popular and topical show at the moment. I've been listening to it, really, really enjoying it, and was delighted to get the chance to grab John for a quick chat. And I'm sure you'll be really excited about this, and you'll take a lot from it. So let's dive straight into it then, the chat this week with John Dryden.
This is an unusual project for Radio 4. It was broadcast on Radio 4, but we approached it right from the beginning as something that would also be available as a podcast, and with the idea that people, audiences, are listening to radio drama in a slightly different way than they did a couple of years ago, or even until quite recently. I think this is the first big series the BBC has podcast. So the idea right from the beginning was to make something that was very layered and textured, that had lots of storylines that actually might demand the audience to concentrate on it a little bit more than they would with for instance, a two-hander play. This is something that is kind of designed to be re-listened to and concentrated on. And as a result of doing that, we hope that the audience experience from listening to it would be sort of deeper. That's what we're aiming for.
There's been a very interesting, I don't know if paradox is the right word, that's been thrown up over the last few weeks. We actually, on the Audio Drama Production Podcast, we had Eric Nazum of Audible on the show. And of course, he was sort of head honcho at NPR for a number of years. And I was asking him some questions about audio drama, and he takes a very, very different view, and he's looking at it, you know, the smaller casts, more direct, and Tumen Bay coming out at a similar time as an epic with lots of characters. And it's really interesting now, this it's almost like we're seeing two different sides of an idea now. Yourself and Fred Greenhalgh as well, who did Lock and Key and The Cleansed and things like that. Are you very much on the side of the sweeping epic that does, like you say, demand a lot of attention from the listener?
I wouldn't say, for me, it's an either or so much that I would sort of come down on one side or the other. I think, you know, what's happening and I'm talking about audio drama, you know, because obviously there's a lot of audio out there, you know, that's documentary and news and all that stuff. But drama-wise, I think it's an amazing time right now that such a vast range actually is being produced. And you know, I'm into the smaller single-voice two-hander thing as much as I am into the epic. I think there's the space for both. And I think it's really encouraging that both are being made. You know, the big game changer for podcasts, and possibly, you know, this is one of the reasons why, you know, some producers and commissioning editors out there are looking more for the single voice, is Serial, which did go global. It was very much a presenter-led single voice thing. It was a very clear story to follow that was full of twists and turns that kept making you think something different every moment. You know, and was tremendously exciting and tremendously successful for that. I think that has made a lot of commissioning editors look more towards what are the simple ideas with less characters, less voice. That was a documentary, by the way, but it's impacted right across, you know, other genres. You know, it's very, very effective. But I don't think that's the only way. I think that there also seems to be a bit of a kind of renaissance of these bigger, sweeping epics like Tumen Bay, which audiences seem to be getting slightly obsessed with. You know, the kind of stuff we're seeing on Twitter is that people are getting binging on it. There's the whole kind of binge culture that's come out of TV, of course. So if they work, the bigger cast programs can pull in a, you know, a very significant audience and a very appreciative audience. That's certainly what we found with Tumen Bay. But it is all about it working. You know, it's a very difficult thing to make in audio, a multicast, multi-storyline drama that works. You know, it's a very fine line between, you know, doing something that's challenging and just simply baffling or confusing the audience. It needs to be very, very well structured to work, I think.
Well, obviously, when you set out to make something like an audio drama, you want people to listen. But was it in your mind that you wanted to have a massive, massive audience? Or would you prefer to have, if you had to choose, would you prefer to have a smaller but more fanatical audience?
It was something that we spoke a lot to the BBC publicity department about early on. And what sometimes happens with these sort of projects is that the BBC, in order to get as much publicity for it as possible, will make it an event. For instance, they did an adaptation of War and Peace that was broadcast in, I think there were like 20-odd episodes of different lengths. Some were like an hour length, some were quite short. It was all broadcast on New Year's Day last year. And so you could sort of tune in at any time of the day and you'd get a bit of War and Peace. And it got a huge amount of publicity, lots of features in the press, because it was something to kind of write about, that Radio 4's schedule was going to be taken over completely by this War and Peace on New Year's Day. I'm not sure how many people listened to the whole thing. It was difficult to miss hearing some of it. But what we didn't, and then there's other projects as well where it'll be a 10-part series and they'll broadcast an episode every day for 2 weeks. And that also gets a lot of press attention. We argued that we wanted Tumen Bay to be one a week for 10 weeks rather than be blitzed, because we wanted the audience to build by word of mouth, and not for it all to suddenly to have a bit of a sort of publicity flurry of features in the newspaper and stuff like that, and then it's suddenly all over before people have really heard that it's even on. We wanted something that was going to last. The danger of that, of course, is that people can lose the thread of the story if there's a week between each episode. But things have changed a lot. Like, for instance, if you heard an episode on the being broadcast on the radio and you wanted to hear the episode that was going to be broadcast next week, there was a facility on the BBC website where you could get online only next week's episode a week before it was broadcast. And the fact that it was being podcast did mean that audiences could hear more than sort of one episode if they wanted to at a go. And so the audience did build over the 10-week period. The downloads built a lot over the 10-week period. Well, there's a lot of tweeting about people binge listening to Tumen Bay. And that was what we wanted. We wanted it to be a huge audience, which it kind of is anyway, you know, when it's broadcast on Radio 4. The afternoon dramas that go out at 2:15 on weekdays, and this was broadcast at 2:15 on a Wednesday. It doesn't sound like the ideal slot, but extraordinarily, the audience for that is just under 1 million people, which is massive. We don't have the figures on the downloads yet, but I think they, from what we're sensing, they increased a lot during the run of Tumen Bay over the weeks. So we wanted a fanatical, obsessed audience. We wanted people to discuss Tumen Bay, to have lots of questions about it. We wanted a lot of activity on social media about Tumen Bay. You know, and I suppose in that sense, we were keen to develop a kind of niche audience. But of course, any program maker wants to have as big an audience as you can get.
I know we're strapped for time, but I just want to maybe ask a couple of more creative questions, if you like, about the making of the show. What really impressed me about Tumen Bay is the way that it moves so fast, like the pacing of the scenes. One thing will be presented in one scene and we move forward quite a bit, but I also don't feel like we're being rushed. How much of the script initially when you were writing these as first drafts ended up on the cutting room floor? Did you have to chop a lot of it?
We didn't, because we were aware of how much material we were going to have to record and how much we were going to have to edit. We were quite disciplined at the script stage, much more so than I would normally be with smaller projects, where you are where I've been reluctant to let things go at the script stage, and we record it, and then inevitably a lot of stuff has to be cut out to make it the right, you know, the program the right length. But with Tomb and Bay, because we knew it was going to be a real struggle recording it and editing it, and we'd have a lot of actors to deal with, we felt that it was important to have the scripts roughly the right length. But I would say each rough edit probably came in at about 4 or 5 minutes over length. So there was, you know, a fair bit of cutting to be done, but nothing like what I've had to cut out in the past in previous projects. We storylined Tomb and Bay very, very carefully before we even started writing the scripts. So it wasn't that difficult. Once we started knowing that we had to write these to length, we just kind of, you know, knew we had to do that. So not that much got cut out. But the style was something that I've very much been sort of working on for a number of years, that sort of fast cutting, moving things along, making sure that every single scene pretty much has some sort of reveal or turning point. So it is a pacey listen for sure. And that was in the scripts, I think.
Yeah, there certainly doesn't seem to be any filler at all, which is really, it just keeps rolling on at a really good pace, which is one of the things I really like about it. I don't want to make you feel old by saying this, but you've been in the game a while now. Obviously, things might have changed quite a bit since you first got into producing radio drama. If you woke up tomorrow as an aspiring radio drama producer, someone who wants to be where you are today, but you don't have any of your expertise or all the knowledge that you'd gained over the years, you're back at square one, what would be some of the first steps that you would take to try and build that career from scratch again?
That's an interesting question. I think to make an impact, you've got to have an idea that is fundamentally original or different to what everyone else is doing. My idea when I started, I'd been making sort of radio documentaries and things like that, and it just struck me that radio drama was so often made in the studio with fixed microphones and actors standing around them, and that they lacked a kind of physicality and a sort of movement and energy and that kind of paciness that you talked about in terms of the way the scenes were cut and stuff like that. You know, when I started making radio drama, most radio dramas would, to end a scene, would sort of fade out, and then the next scene would fade in to very, very clearly tell the audience that a new scene was coming. Whereas I tended to favor much more sort of hard cuts with very different sounding backgrounds so that you would know that the scene was different. But my idea was to essentially make a radio drama in the same way that one would make a radio documentary, which is on the real streets in locations that were as close as possible to what the story was set in, and then do a lot of post-production so that it had a totally different feel to something that was created in a studio setting. And I kind of stuck with that, I guess. So I would recommend to someone trying to, I think it's about having a niche, you know, having a style that people recognize, so that when they hear the program, when anyone hears the program on the radio, they can think, yep, that's that person that made that. There's always a lot of studio type productions that are sitting on the commissioning editor's desk waiting to be commissioned. And most of them are probably pretty good, and he could either commission them or not commission them, and it wouldn't really make much difference whether he went for this one or that one. When you've got something that is sort of its own, it'll sit on a different pile on the commissioning editor's desk. Maybe be more likely to get commissioned. So that's probably the way to kind of make a mark and create a career, I would say. Of course, it depends whether you see yourself as a producer or a writer. You know, I saw myself as a sort of producer-director, I suppose, really. So for me, it was all about the production style and then applying that to the various scripts that I was able to develop with other writers.
Huge thanks to John there. Really enjoyed that, and some great advice there for aspiring producers and producers who've been in the game for a wee while as well. And before we get wrapped up this week, I just wanted to say a big thanks to Paul of AtheistApocalypse.com. That's a fictional comedy podcast set in a post-apocalyptic world. Paul was very kind and pledged to support this podcast on Patreon, so he does become a proud member of the Knights of the Pledge, helping us to keep this show going, and we're beginning to build a very modest war chest to fund Valenhigh in the summer as well. We're going to be hiring a couple of studios, getting some actors in, so we're going to start investigating ways to fund that, basically, that'll involve us keeping our clothes and eating meat during the duration of that. Exciting times for Robert and I this week, because we are meeting up with Matthew and Monique Boudreau in Edinburgh on Wednesday for a couple of pints. Those guys are over in the UK and Ireland next week, so I'm sure they'll be meeting up with a few folks over there and down south. Then they come up to Edinburgh. They have the pleasure of meeting up with myself and Robert and Michelle LaFrance at the Owl Field as well, hopefully. So very excited for that. Hope they've brought their wallets and are prepared to buy us a lot of pints with their holiday money. So that's it for this episode. If you want to get in touch with us, the email address is podcast@audiodramaproduction.com and the website is audiodramaproduction.com. Have a good week, and we'll hopefully speak to you in 7 days' time.